let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim R., and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting on NABA Zoom, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and wisdom to know the difference. This is AA Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help others to achieve sobriety.
Everybody, I'm Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in our own language and their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our NABA Zoom room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear tonight's speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. Now, I am always honored to get this position of introducing our speaker. It's funny because today we were just talking about how long we've been good friends, and it's about 12 years we've known each other. We've been to thousands of AA meetings together. I've heard his story dozens of times, and of course it's changed over the years, but he is a master of carrying the message and not the mess, which you will hear tonight. He is my very dear friend, and with that I give you Tinsley.
Hey, my name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And thanks for the kind words, Julie. So my sobriety date is May 3rd, 1999. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor other men. And this is my home group, the Zoom meeting of 8 o'clock Monday. And I am 63 years old. I like to give my age so that you're not like me and try to figure out the age of the speaker. That's what I do the whole meeting. So I'm just going to rip the Band-Aid off and tell you that I'm 63 years old. I'll just start at the very beginning. I was born here in Atlanta at Piedmont Hospital when my parents were Emory students. And my dad was a law student there and my mom was an undergraduate, young parents. We lived here in Atlanta until they both graduated from Emory and then moved down to South Florida, Broward County, Florida, where my dad went into his dad's law practice. So I could tell you that if I had to characterize my upbringing, I would tell you that it was of the silver spoon variety. I went to the best summer camps and got a car when I was 16, when I got my learner's permit. I got a car, promptly wrecked it. I went to a private school from 7th grade to 12th grade. And it was one of those kind of private schools where you wear a coat and a tie, and the coat had the school patch on it. And then since it was in South Florida half the year, we wore short pants. So Tim likes to call that my Angus Young period. You know, that's not a favorite attire of teenagers everywhere, really. It was a great education. And looking back, glad I was able to thank my parents profusely for my education, but that is not where I wanted to be at the time. I wanted to be with my other friends, wearing whatever, jeans and t-shirts or whatever. And so I always vowed when I grew up, which would be now, that I would never dress like that again. And I do, you know, occasionally dress like that at a solemn occasion, or maybe there's a speaker meeting that requires a coat and tie, and I respect the program and will do that for those meetings gladly. But I always felt sort of out of place for going to that school. And plus, I was kind of churchy. I made really good grades until I began my descent into alcoholism. And I, you're really nerdy, a nerdy kid in school. I was the president of the Glee Club. It was a Episcopal high school. We were the Flying Scotsman at the Glee Club. Now, that being the president of the Glee Club, that's not exactly a cool thing to be in high school. And I always felt out of place for that, definitely. And years later, I met somebody, a recovered alcoholic, and he said, well, if it makes you feel any better, I was president of the library club. And I thought, oh, you got me beat on that one. So I got a little bit of humility later on, but not when I needed it, which was at the awkward age of being a teenager. But that all changed when I went to my first teenage party that somebody's parents were out of town, and I guess I was like 15 years old, and somebody handed me a beer. And I started in on that beer, and I was amazed before I was halfway through. I knew a new freedom. All of a sudden, everything made sense to me, and it was a real banner day in my life. And, you know, a normal person, a normal drinker, they would say something like, you know, I think I had a beer with my cousins or something when I was 16 years old or something, but I can remember what kind of beer it was, and I can remember the way I felt, and it was one of those aha moments. I've only really had two aha moments in my life, except for the first time I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan's show, but that was a different kind of aha moment. But the first aha moment I've ever had in my life where I really saw things so clearly and delivered so many promises. The first one was when I had that first beer. And of course, the other aha moment was at my very first AA meeting, hearing the laughter and feeling like things were gonna pick up. But that first beer, I tell you what, I drank that beer and I went home and I thought about it. And of course, the next weekend I went out with my friends and we got really drunk. It took me down the scale. There was no controlling it. I figured, the alcoholic way of thinking is if one beer makes you feel that good, what would 12 of them do? And I found out, and that's the way I drank from then on. It was on, you know, I don't have a drinking problem. I have a stopping problem. And it was in college that I noticed that I drank different than other people. I'm jumping a little bit ahead, but I'm going to college now, and I'm really honing my drinking skills. And I noticed that we would all get good and drunk pretty much on a nightly basis. And then my friends, about 1 in the morning, would pile into a car and go off to the Waffle House and eat. And I never got in that car with them. It's like, you're going to go eat? I mean, eat? Really? I'll bring you right down. I just kept right on drinking. And that was the allergy. And I always knew I was an alcoholic. I just didn't know what it meant until I came into AA and got the book and went to the meetings and heard y'all talk about the problem we have with stopping. But going back to high school, there was a time in my life where drinking was fun, and we did lots of wild stuff. Lots of wild things happened, and you know, outrageous stuff. And I'm just going to say it. It sounds crazy when I say it, but I was at a teenage party. I guess maybe I was in 11th grade or something at a party, and I shot a bottle rocket out of my ass at the party. And I was the man. On Monday, I was back to school, and everybody's talking about it in high school. And, well, the problem with that is you got to top it. And, the way I found to top that was, I started playing in rock bands. I mentioned the Beatles earlier, and, that was a real turning point. I heard the music, and I still love that music, and I still do music to this day, blessed with being able to do what I want to do. But initially, when I got into the band thing and playing with older people, and I can tell you all I want that they corrupted me, but I tell you, I arrived very corruptible. And but one thing I really believed was that I believe that Jimi Hendrix played the hell out of a guitar because he was messed up. And right away in the big book, of course, they don't mention Jimi Hendrix, but they talk on page 2 in Bill's story. He says, "Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived." And that's how I felt. I felt like I got to get out of it if I want to get into it. And I really believe that. And I chase that. I chase that. The big lie is what Stevie Ray Vee, who is one of us, he called it the big lie. And the big lie was that Jimi Hendrix played the guitar great because he was messed up. And of course, we know now that people like Ernest Hemingway or Jimi Hendrix, they got their gift from up there, not from a bottle or a baggie. And, I had to find that out the hard way, but I thought it was really bringing something to the table. And of course, later in the literature, that great sentence that I love, it says, "Your imagination will be fired." And, what that means is that I'm going to get creativity. I'm going to tap into this innermost resource that I've always had, but that I was blocking with the very thing that I thought was going to bring that creativity, that imagination, which was alcohol in all its forms. So, I went down that rabbit hole, definitely. And I went off to college and started playing in bands. It's a wonder that I ever graduated from college. But I did, and immediately I joined a rock band, a blues band, which is my favorite kind of music. I had seen B.B. King as a teenager, and I decided that that was the music for me. And an unlikely choice of a genre for a preppy kid like me, but that's just the way it turned out. That's the music that resonates with me, and it all comes from the blues anyway. It's either blues or zippity-doo-dah. Those are the two types of music that there are. And so I graduated from college, and I didn't follow my parents' wish and go off to law school. At that point, I did a little later, didn't work out well. You know, law school is not like college. In law school, they expect results. And, and I was not able to deliver in my active alcoholism. So I only lasted 3 weeks in law school later. But, initially after college, I want to say this one thing, about college. I was too drunk to be in a fraternity in college, which is really saying something. I couldn't pull it off. I was too much of a drunk, but I went to all their parties. And then I started playing at their parties in bands that I was in right after college. And I went on the road. We went all over the place. And these guys were older than me, and they corrupted me. But like I say, it said I arrived corruptible. And we went all over. But that's when my consequences started happening. And one of the first consequences that happened was that I guess I was maybe 21 years old. And I drank myself into the hospital with a bleeding perforated ulcer. And my parents came up from South Florida, of course, and came to my rescue. They'd still be doing that if they were both alive now. And if I needed to be rescued in that way, they'd still be doing it. But, they came up, of course, no health insurance. Sorry, Mom and Dad. I was in the hospital hooked up to machines for a week, at 21 years old. The band continued on the road without me, and I caught up with them a month later. But, you know, I can remember the doctor coming in at the time of discharge and telling my parents, reading from a chart, he said, Mr. Ellis appears to be nothing more than a binge drinker. I remember thinking, yes, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic like some other people. I was a binge drinker. And so I continued right on drinking. Then lots of other consequences happened. And I remember, people were calling me out for my drinking, which doesn't really happen much in music. And I've shared this before, and I'll share it again because I think it hits the nail on the head. When it comes to playing in bands, there's only two rules when it comes to drinking. Rule number one, no drinking during the gospel numbers. Rule number two, no gospel numbers. So basically it was wide open to do whatever I wanted to do, but still I got called out for my drinking. So I decided that what I needed to do is start my own band. And that's what I did. And then nobody could call me out on it. So by the time I got to my very first AA meeting in 1990, by that time, everybody thought it was a good idea that I go to AA. Even the dope man thought it was a good idea that I go to AA. And when the dope man is the voice of reason, then brother, you got a problem. And I certainly did. I came in at, in 1990 and, checked it out, kicked the tires, got a soft cover book because I really did not feel like I had a hardcover recovery in me at that time. But I came in to get everybody off my back. And so, of course, it didn't work. For the next 9 years, I was, I could tell you that it was definitely me on an ocean of half measures. And you know what they say about half measures? They say that, I figured that half measures would at least avail me half, right? Logically, half measures avail me half. No, they avail me nothing. In fact, all they did was, it would bring me farther down, which is where I needed to go. So for 9 years, in and out of the rooms, picking up dirty chips, because, you know, at that time I would enjoy, you know, whatever anybody offered me as long as it wasn't alcohol. And I switched from alcohol to drugs, which is like changing seats on the Titanic. The ship is going down and I'm looking for a more comfortable deck chair. And I did that for 9 years. And then in 1999, at the urging of one of my best friends, I came back into the program and I arrived in a lot different shape at that point. When I came in 1990, I was sarcastic and laughing, you know, joking about it. In 1999, when I arrived at that meeting, I arrived in tears. Had what they call, what is known as the gift of desperation. I really felt like I was, a goner at that point. I was only 32 years old, when I first came in, and, I guess I wasn't ready yet. And all the reasons were wrong. It didn't do it for me. But when I was 41 years old, when I came in, I did it for me. And I started hanging out, after the meetings, and it was the second or third day I was hanging out, because prior to that, I would get there late, leave early, and didn't meet anybody or anything like that. I did not involve other people in my recovery, in my attempts to recover. All I did was read the book and go to a few meetings and wonder why it wasn't working. But when I came back in for hopefully to pick up my final white chip, in 1999, like I say, I arrived in tears and I hung out and I talked to this guy after the meeting. And of course he told me that, he knew what I did for a living and, he flattered me with the fan talk, which I love that. I still love that. But, so of course I wanted to talk to him and, but he talked to me in a way that no other man had ever talked to me. And prior to that, the outside world, the rest of the world, people would talk to me like, they'd go, well, you know what your problem is? Or they'd say, well, what you got to do is, and they'd kind of lecture me, you know, and I didn't want to hear that. But he told me what it had been like for him and, what happened and what he did now and what his life was like now. And then he let me talk. And he talked a little and I talked a little and I felt this kinship with this guy that I'd never felt before because, frankly, I had not allowed the fellowship into my life. I would just go check in for an hour and leave, you know, and try to make my way in recovery the best I could. I remember him telling me, he said, if you want what I have, do what, if you want what I have, do what I did. And, I was curious to know what he was talking about. He told me that if I would do 5 things, I would stand a great chance of staying clean and sober. 1, go to a ton of meetings. 2, get a competent sponsor of my own gender. 3, work all 12 steps in order. 4, learn how to pray. And 5, work with others. And I needed it dummied down because it was just so confusing to me when I first came in. There were 12 steps on one wall, and there were 12 traditions, and there was a principle behind each of the steps and a principle behind each of the traditions. And gee, that seemed like 48 things right there. But he was talking about 5 things, and keeping it simple really, really helped me a lot. You know, this is this definitely is a simple program for complicated people. It's simple if we choose to make it that way, if it's presented to us that way. And it's complicated because we will complicate stuff. And it's simple, but it's not easy. The book says that. And it's not easy because it involves work. And work isn't fun. If work was fun, they'd call it going to fun in the morning, but they don't. And so basically, him keeping it simple really interested me. And I'll just break it down the way it was broken down to me over time. And what I've realized is that the meetings, the first thing he recommended, go to a ton of meetings. The meetings are a place that I can go to change the way I feel. Men and women go to meetings essentially for the effect produced by going to meetings. You know, I'm irritable. I'm mad at something. I don't feel right. I go to a meeting. I feel better after the meeting. Every time. Yeah, I can't think of it. Hardly any time where I've ever left madder than when I got there. And it changes the way I feel to go to a meeting. But the meeting is also a place where I can hear stories about what happens to people who stop going to meetings. And that's a cautionary tale. It won't necessarily keep me sober, but I need to remember that every time I've seen or heard about somebody coming back in after a period of being dry without this program, invariably what I hear them say is, well, I slacked off on my meetings. So people who aren't at the meetings aren't there at the meetings to hear about what happens to people who aren't at the meetings. It's the only place I hear this message. And plus, I enjoy it. And I remember thinking, how long do I got to go to these meetings? And I was told that I only have to go to the meetings until I want to go to the meetings. And that's where I'm at now. I enjoy going. And I enjoy going on Zoom. What a blessing it is to be able to come. And I've been to 3 meetings today. One at 7 in the morning up in Asheville that I really like. And then, of course, the 5:45. And then this meeting. And it's not because I don't have a life. It's because I enjoy going. And frankly, these Zoom meetings make it very convenient to do that. So the second thing he recommended is to get a competent sponsor of my own gender. Wouldn't you know it, he appointed himself my sponsor. You know, I'm glad he did that because I don't know that I would have done that if it hadn't been for him demanding that he was going to do that. And so I said, okay, well, all right, you know. And he liked to say, he goes, a sponsor is not a ride or a banker or a psychiatrist or a lawyer or marriage counselor. The sponsor's job is to take the sponsee through the steps and to help them, especially to see our part in the harms and the resentments and stuff like that, to help us see our part. In fact, I know a person who said that their sponsor, in the days of caller ID, now we can tell who's calling, but this certain sponsor, whenever he sees that it's a sponsee calling, he answers the phone by saying, it's not their fault, because he knows he's going to get around to saying that anyway. And that's how he answers calls from his sponsees. That's kind of funny, but nobody calls their sponsor to listen. We call to gripe and do all the complaining and to do all the talking. And I'm certainly that way as well. And so when I sponsor people, I steer them back into the step work and into the rooms and help them see their part in things. And you know, my sponsor, that was getting a sponsor was the turning point in my recovery. And he was really nice at first, But then he started telling me stuff about myself that I didn't want to hear what he was saying. But I sat there and I took it. And I really think that that was a turning point in my recovery, is when I became willing to hear stuff about me that I would not have been willing to have heard prior to that. And I think the reason is because I could recall with sufficient force the pain and suffering of my last debauch. And I knew that I needed to change. I knew something was going to have to be different. And I was sitting there and becoming willing to listen to these cold, hard facts about myself was definitely a turning point that I would not have been able to do when I wasn't ready to stop drinking. I would have just avoided the person and the place. You know, I would have not have gone back there. Being that the sponsor's job, in my opinion, is to take the sponsee through the steps. Step one, I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. And I mentioned the powerlessness earlier, how once I get started, I can't stop. But that's only part of the powerlessness. The problem is that I drink when I don't want to drink, or maybe I have that sick need to drink in the morning. So it's a twofold thing. I drink when I don't want to drink, and once I get started, then I can't stop. And then the unmanageability. I really, one of the reasons that I couldn't launch into this course of action, which is the process of the steps, is because I had houses, I had stuff, I had cars, I had a career. I could always point to that to prove that my life was not unmanageable. But what I lacked in that area, I'm more than made up for in the self-loathing department. I truly hated myself, and I hated myself because I drank, and I drank because I hated myself. It was a vicious, vicious cycle. So when I finally got to the point where I realized that not only was I powerless over alcohol in all its forms, but I also, my life was unmanageable, and I didn't get into trouble every time I drank, but every time I got in trouble, there was some drinking going on in there. Some mind-altering substances as well. So getting past step one was something that I was not able to do without a sponsor's help. And we got to step two in the book. And my sponsor also used the 12 and 12, which is a book I very much like. And I think that one of the reasons the 12 and 12 was written is because steps like step two, for instance, or step eight was Bill Wilson. I don't think he felt like he were explain those steps as well as he would have liked to. And he had a little more sobriety, and he expounded upon step two. I didn't understand what the higher power thing had to do with my drinking problem. I tried this program without seeking a higher power and could not stay sober. And that's what it had to do with my drinking problem. And my sponsor, he took me through step two and the 12 and 12. And he got to that sentence, which said, "You can, if you'd like, even make AA itself your higher power." Now, that is one that I quote verbatim, because that is the sentence that pretty much saved my ass. Because I could understand how 35 people with a desire and a plan to stay sober was greater than one person, me, my plan. 35 is greater than one. 35 is a higher power of one. And so I took it piecemeal, like the book says, and y'all became my higher power. And then the clubhouse became my higher power, and that wasn't big enough. And then the clubhouse and the parking lot and the meeting after the meeting became my higher power. And I want to say this about the meeting after the meeting. That is the way I think the newcomer, which was me at one point, that is how I identified is that meeting after the meeting before the meeting. And I was at a group one time, and somebody called that the 2020 club, the people that get there 20 minutes early and stay 20 minutes late. He said that the 2020 club is for the people who stay sober. But getting back to the use of the program is a higher power. I did that initially, and then I was able to grow it, and then the room, and then the parking lot, and then I found that it became portable. I was at my uncle's funeral early in recovery, and I found myself praying to the same higher power in that funeral as I do at the end of the meeting. And so then all of a sudden I realized that this is something that can be portable, that I can take around with me. And then we got to step three. And after the meeting, he said, okay, I want you to grab a book off the shelf and meet me in the, this was at a meeting place called the Log Cabin. And they had a little side room. And after the meeting, people gathered and talking. And then he took me into the side room and said, all right, go to where the third step prayer is, and he told me what page it's on. And in fact, he had me fold down the page of my book, which is still folded down, to that prayer. He said, okay, we're going to kneel down, and we're going to say that third step prayer together. And you're going to put your arm around my shoulder, and I'm going to put my arm around your shoulder, and we're going to say the third step. I remember thinking, oh, hell no. But then I could remember sufficient force, the pain and suffering of my last debauch, and I realized that it was going to be either the floor or the door. So I hit the floor with him, and it just was a reminder to me that in recovery, it's not just me doing what I don't want to do. It's me doing what I don't understand why I'm doing it. And I'm getting the results from it. And so we did that third step prayer, and I made my surrender, and which is what they used to call it in the early days of AA at Dr. Bob's house. I believe they'd take a recruit upstairs into, one of the bedrooms upstairs, and they'd probably use a Bible at that point, I'm imagining. They'd pray, and it invariably one of two things would happen. Either the new person would say no and leave, maybe go out and do some more drinking, or he would kneel down and say that prayer. And they call that making the surrender. Then we got to step four, and I didn't want to do step four, and I dragged my feet up. And my sponsor said, I want you to bring your some of your fourth step work and show it to me next time we meet at the meeting. And so I got there, and of course I didn't have any work to show him. And he said, what happened? Where's your work? And I said, well, I'm real busy. I'm a busy guy, and I haven't had a good time to start. And he said, well, let me suggest a good time to begin your fourth step. He said, a good time to begin your fourth step is when you're done drinking. And I did it. And it was the first tangible evidence of my desire to stay sober. Got to step, and when I say this about step four, the stuff that I put down there, my harms and my unmade amends and my resentments and my fears, those are not the things that made me a hard drinker. I was a hard drinker because I'm an alcoholic, but those are things that kept me thirsty. The list of stuff that keeps me thirsty, that'll drive me back towards a drink without this program. So we get to step five, and I didn't want to do that either. I found myself driving about 30 miles an hour in the car on the way over there. That's how much I dreaded it. But we got there, and he told me some stuff about himself, and that put me at ease. And then I started telling him, reading him and realizing that I had a part in all of these harms. I had a part in all these resentments. I had a part in all these unmade amends. And it was a real aha moment to me in seeing that my problems are mostly of my own making. And I felt relief from that. And we got to step six. And you know, that's a short step in the book, but step six and seven, this whole process of giving my resentments and fears, for instance, to a higher power. What good does it do for me to make a list of all the things that have kept me thirsty for so long and to tell someone about it? What good does it do to that if I'm not willing to be willing or entirely ready to have God or AA, it may be for somebody, to have that process relieve those things from me, to unburden me with that. And I love it what Rusty shared about one time at a meeting. He said that in steps six and seven, we fine tune our instincts that have run amok. You know, because I'm an alcoholic and I take everything to the limit, past the limit. I overshoot the mark every time. So I think fears, you know, if a little bit of fear kept me alive in shark infested waters, wouldn't a whole bunch of fear make me immortal? Or if a little bit of standing up for myself got me my own way, wouldn't a whole bunch of resentment and anger, wouldn't that get me my way everywhere? And what Rusty said was that, no, in steps in 6 and 7, we don't abandon these instincts that have been given to us for a reason. We fine-tune them. And he pointed out that when my guitar goes out of tune, I don't clip the guitar strings off. I tune the instrument. I reach up there and tune those guitar strings. I don't cut them off. And so I liken steps 6 and 7 to tuning the instrument. And the instrument is my will in my life, which is my thoughts and my actions, and my instincts that have far exceeded their use. Steps 8 and 9. Wow. Step 8 was real easy for me because I basically put down everybody I knew. That's the people that I needed to make amends to. And of course, I try to do this after step 1 without a sponsor's help, you know, go to everybody and say, I'm sorry. And they knew I was sorry. I didn't need to say that. I had said it so many times before. But in this time around, with the sponsor's help, I was able to prioritize and to call the list and to make it something that I was going to be able to do effectively and to let people see that a change had been made, because that's all my parents wanted to see, for instance, is that I was going to be well and happy. They did not need for me to say I'm sorry anymore. And that's why I think in the government, when they amend the Constitution, they don't apologize to the Constitution. They change it. They fix it. So that's what amends means to me, is making that change, going to people and saying I'm wrong and feeling the relief from that as well with the 9th step promises. And 9th step promises are amazing. I love where it says fear of economic insecurity will leave us. It doesn't say economic insecurity will leave us. It says the fear of it, the perception of it, which alcoholism is a disease of perception. We don't see things the way they are. In the back of the book, and I believe in The Family Afterwards, or maybe To the Wives, it says the alcoholic lives in a world that is distorted and exaggerated. And that's a good reason to have a team of experts headed up by a sponsor so that I can see the way things really are. Get to step 10. Wow. If step 9 promises are not extravagant promises, step 10 may be the extravagant ones, because thanks to this process that I've already learned, I've gotten to the point where I've got these tools to deal with my resentments and these tools to deal with my fears. I've got a process and I've got a team of experts, and I can match these calamities with some serenity thanks to the help of this process and my network. And I get to a place where I'm not thirsty anymore. Things don't rock my boat. I'm not even really thinking about drinking anymore. In the step 10 promises, it says, no longer fighting alcohol. Well, that's good, because every time I fought it, it won. We're not swearing off alcohol. Well, that's good, because every time I swore off, it swore back on. We're not shielding ourselves from alcohol. Well, that's good, because I don't know a shield strong enough to shield me from alcohol. And in step 10, I think what they're talking about is, if we're not doing those things, what are we doing? And I believe by this point, we have built the type of life that we no longer want to escape from. We no longer want to escape from this life that we have built. We wouldn't trade it for anything. And that's why those steps are in order. And that's why the promises are in order. I get to step 11, which, you know, part of me maintaining my sobriety and my sanity and my happiness, and realizing that I've got a conversational relationship with God now. It was higher power, and now it's God, and growing a higher power that I can have this conversational relationship with. And if I'm not feeling religious or something, I can say a prayer. One of my favorite prayers is, what would those people at the 545 tell me to do? And I can realize that a higher power is speaking through y'all when I come to that crossroads that I reach. And I've got these tools to do it. And another favorite prayer of mine is one that Julie taught me. One time I had to go see my my old bandmate. He was dying of cancer. He wasn't going to make it. And I knew I needed to go see him. And I went to the hospital. And what do I do? And evidently, this is a prayer that's been floating around the rooms for a long time. She told me that when I got to his hospital door, that I should say this prayer. I should say, okay, God, you go first. And I did that. I said, okay, God, you go first. And I opened the door, and there he was laying in the bed. Didn't even look like himself. He didn't look good. He didn't last much longer than that. But thanks to that prayer, I was able to go in there and talk to him. And we kept it lighthearted. We didn't even talk about his illness. We talked about the old days. And I said, I'll see you, Bob. And he said, I love you, Tinsley. I'll see you too. And I really do hope I see him again. And so what a program to teach me all these prayers. And then the step 12, which I believe is the key to long-term recovery. Wow. What a step, step 12 is. And I'm going to read, probably my favorite. I pulled it up on my computer here, so I'll have to squint and look at it in the book, and I can make some hand gestures too if I choose to, which I do. Step 12. It says it great in Bill's story. And at this point, he doesn't even have a program, really. There's no steps. There's no book. There's no meetings. He's just winging it. And he writes on page 15, my wife and I abandon ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution of their problems. It was fortunate for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time and was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink, but I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Many times I have gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It is a design for a living that works in rough going. Wow. Amazing. He would go there and he would talk to somebody in the detox ward and tell them that they could find a way out. And he would forget his unemployment problems. He would forget his marital problems. He would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. He would be amazingly lifted up. That's what I wanted alcohol to do for me. It did. It amazingly lifted me up initially, but it let me down every time after that. You know, this program, AA, and this fellowship delivers everything that alcohol promised but failed to deliver. The sense of camaraderie, the laughter. Boy, we laugh at some weird stuff at meetings sometimes, don't we? But we laugh a lot, and we do it without a drink in our hand. We didn't need a drink to begin with. We had those ruby slippers all along. And amazingly sit on my feet, pick me up. That's what I wanted alcohol to do. AA delivers everything that alcohol promised but failed to deliver. It is a design for a living that works in rough going. The going's going to get rough. The going got rough for me 2 months ago when my son died of this disease. It took him. He had a long fight with it in and out of the rooms. It took him down. It killed him. I can tell you that not once since that happened, not early on, not along the way, not now, not once have I thought about taking a drink or a drug. Now that's a miracle. The miracle of this program isn't that I don't drink or drug. The miracle of the program is that I don't want to drink or drug. Thank you for my sobriety.
Thank you, Tinsley, so much. Such a great story. And, you know, I have to tell you guys, every time he tells that bottle rocket story, I think about the first line of in the 12 and 12 for step 9, where it talks about good judgment, a careful sense of timing, courage, and prudence. These are the qualities we shall need. Well, clearly he did not have good judgment or prudence, and I don't think it's the kind of courage they're talking about, but thank God for his careful sense of timing. That's all
I had good timing, definitely.
Very good timing. Thank God. we might not have heard that story tonight had it not been for his careful sense of good timing. You know, we do have some time before the very end of the meeting. Does anybody want to say anything about to Tinsley or about the story or resonate with anybody?
I just want to say thank you, Tinsley, and thank God for your wonderful sense of timing and for your wonderful sense of humor. I love you so much. Thank you. It was a great, great share. Thanks.
Thank you, Tinsley. It's Anna Doris. I'm an alcoholic. It was really great, and it's interesting. You actually could be a lawyer because you when you share, you're like a teacher because you dummy down things for me and reduce them, and it's almost like you're drawing diagrams and painting pictures, and so it's very helpful. Your story was great. Thank you.
Your bottle rocket story reminds me of why men don't live as long as women. You know, it's just one of those. It seemed to be a good idea at the time, and I'm glad that there are no particular scars. At least I hope there aren't. I'll take your word for that.
You know what I said right before I did it? I said, "Hold my beer." Famous last words.
Hey, this is John. I'm an alcoholic. Tinsley, I just want to thank you so much, particularly for a newcomer. That was just absolutely incredible to hear, and I don't know, my heart's full. Thanks so much, Tinsley.
Love you, John.
I'm Barbara, alcoholic, and I knew your sponsor, and you are the product of great sponsorship. He impacted me early on. Thank you.
I'm Betty, alcoholic. Tinsley, I don't know you very well, but thank you so, so very much. I got a lot of identification. I got sober in Fort Lickerdale. Does that count?
Yes.
It amazed me, and I really appreciate it. In fact, I took a couple of notes of things that I can use with the women I work with. So, again, thank you. It was wonderful.
Great. I just want you to know, I love the story, and I could really relate to a lot of your story. Thank you so much for sharing it. I kicked the tires a while, too, and I appreciated it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Gary.
Yes, I just appreciate what you said. It's starting to click now because my sponsor was asking me something about, you know, what role I played in things. What did I do? And when I heard Tinsley speaking, something similar to that. I'm not an angel myself, and we just had this discussion, her and I, like yesterday. So it's really starting to click that I too have my flaws, and I just really enjoyed it, and it was clicking. And I appreciate you. Thank you.
Tinsley, I'm Jane, and part about the men's. It wasn't an AA situation, but I was having a home blessing. And I didn't know what to expect. I should have known what to expect because I'd been to somebody else's, but I wasn't around people that I had been involved with, so it didn't hit me. But when here, one of the lines that you repeated was you turned to the person next to you and said, "Please forgive me. It's all my fault." And I thought, that was a big surprise when I had to turn to people that I had life connections with. And I remember my daughter-in-law said to me, "All your fault," because she thought it was all her fault. It was one of those things I couldn't figure out, but it didn't hurt to say it, you know. So thank you.
Thank you, Jane, and thank you guys and Tinsley for a good meeting. We have asked Patty to hand out our virtual chips, and I believe that Gary is going to be her Vanna White while she...
Yeah, yes, he is. Hi, I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. Hell of an AA story, Tinsley. Man, oh man, I learn something from you every time you open your mouth. So tonight we are going to honor those, celebrate a little bit of time. I'd like to give out a white chip for anybody wanting to come in just for today, try our way of life for 24 hours, surrender to win. All righty, how about 30 days, 30 long nights, silver chip? Lots of sobriety here. Okay, how about 60 days and a bronze chip? Anybody for 60? Lord, no. Okay. How about 90 days? 3 months. I think we've got a 3 month in the house.
Yeah, that's me. I've got 3 months today.
Yay!
Good job, Adam.
Adam.
Thanks, everybody. Yeah, I celebrated in the 5:45, but I'm gonna keep celebrating until midnight tonight, right?
There you go. Keep celebrating until you pick up the next one. How about yellow chip? 6 months, sunshine chip. Anybody got six months? Okie doke. How about 9 months, green chip? Grass is growing between you and the liquor store, the whole deal. All right, guys, how about a year or multiples thereof? Any birthdays tonight? One more time for the white chip. Anybody want to come in just for today? All right. Well, congratulations on the chips you hold, and thanks for letting me serve.
Thank you, Patty and Gary. Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight. In finishing, we're going to take a brief period for AA, NABA Club, and NavaZoom announcements, and I have one, and that is next week at the exact same time, 8 o'clock on Monday, on the Zoom meeting, our very own Jenny W. will be telling her story. And a lot of us have gotten to know her at the 5:45, and she celebrated her 1 year. She's a Zoom baby for sure, and we can't wait to hear her story.
Well, I was going to announce that Jenny W. was going to be our speaker, so you got that. I'll do a brief rundown on those that are coming up also. We've got Mike B. Everybody knows Mike. If you don't, you ought to. But he's been involved with NABA for years and years. And Tinsley talked about this gentleman tonight, Bill B., will be our speaker April 26th. So that's Monday, 8 p.m., April 26th. And then Carrie J. of the Sunday 4 p.m. Deaf and Sober Group. And usually when she speaks, she's doing sign language too, and she'll have some of her fellow home group members in attendance. So hope you guys come back and enjoy all that, get a lot out of it. And have a good time. We like to have fun. Thanks.
That's a heck of a lineup you have there, Tim. All right. Well, if there are no further announcements, I remind each of you that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. For those who will, please join hands metaphorically in the Lord's Prayer. And if you'd unmute yourself so we can all hear each other, that would be great. And we will close with the Lord's Prayer. Who keeps us sober?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Give us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory.
Thanks, Tinsley.
Thank you, Tinsley. Wonderful story.
Well done, Tinsley. That was real AA, buddy.
Yeah, good job, nice. Tinsley.
I feel good.
That's awesome, Tinsley.
Strange to me, as I roam from town to town, can't put the bottle down. Right now feels like it's killing me. Life out here gets so depressing. Need something to take the edge, you see.